Okay, this is 27 February 1978 at Radio Physics in Sydney, and talking with John Whiteoak. Now, you say you started off as a graduate student. When and where was that?
I began as a graduate student in optical astronomy around about March 1958. So this entailed me spending 4 years at Mount Stromlo Observatory while Bart Pock was director, and ended in February 1962. At this time, I was waiting to go to America on a Carnegie Institute fellowship. Mm-hmm. And while I was waiting, I spent probably 7 or 8 months at Radio Physics during the time that the Parkes dish had just come into operation and was just being set up for general use, so that I spent most of my time helping Jim Roberts do all the pointing correction.
Okay, well, before we get to that, what was the main thrust of your graduate training? It was optical astronomy.
Yeah, graduate training was optical and mainly centered on early type O and B star observations and correlation with H2 regions and to a certain extent radio continuum contours and whatnot. And so as such, I was fairly well associated, quite well associated with people at Radio Physics in Sydney.
And which people in particular?
Well, I think mostly it was McGee at that stage.
Who was doing what wavelength?
Well, he was doing 21 centimeter research at that time. I think that they had only come starting to use a multi-channel backend, which they plugged onto a, I don't know, was it 20 foot telescope at Murray Bank?
No,
like
it's 2.8 degree beam, so that would make it what?
Yeah, it might have been 24 foot.
It was
out of order. It was quite a small one. But they had some quite interesting contours. And one of the things that we were interested in at one stage was whether, in fact, one could associate these contours with things like OB associations and early type clusters on which I was working at Mount Stromlo.
Now, who was it that was more or less directing you in your studies? Was it Bock and...
Yeah, Bock was the sort of overall director,
and
the other person with whom I was associated was Alex Rogers, who was a thesis supervisor at that stage.
And was it Bock who more or less encouraged you in the radio studies, would you say? Or
yeah, about Bock entirely. At every time, Bart Bock was quite interested in having an association between Mount Stromlo and the radio astronomers in Sydney. And as such, he was very keen that either his people or a group of his people would visit Sydney at least once, twice a year, or that the reverse would happen, that Joe Pawsey would bring up a group from Sydney, and we'd sit down for a day or two and talk about things of mutual interest.
Can you think of any of these specific times this happened?
The time that I can think of in particular, and this is probably because I had to edit the proceedings, unfortunately, I don't have a copy of the thing here, was around about December 1958. at this stage, I think the McGee multi-channel receiver had just come into operation, and he had quite a few interesting profiles and results on the distribution of H-line. And so Joe Pawsey brought up a group of people from Radio Physics, including McGee and Murray and Alex Shane, Heinemann, there might have been one or two others.
Mm-hmm.
And so we arranged, I think, a 1 or 2 day colloquium, or more or less a sort of informal symposium, where they showed their results. And on the other side, there were people like Alex Rogers and Hugh Johnson and myself at Mount Stromlo, and we talked about H2 region and optical observations, and the survey, the H2 region survey, was being done at Mount Stromlo at that time. I can remember in particular Joe Pawsey was worried a little bit about the area around about the Gum Nebula, or the Vela Puppis Nebula, as it might be called. and the Sydney people had some interesting profiles. I think perhaps they must have been continuum profiles, because there was one set of southern continuum profiles, plots, I should say, that they are trying to associate with the optical contours. And I have a feeling there's one that looked like a bit like a fish. You can still see this as part of the Vela Papas Nebula. It's one of the more southern extensions. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a bit of waffle on this and interpretation and whatnot. And I forgot what they call it, but anyway, I think Joe put it one stage that he thought that although it looked like a fish, the whole talk might turn out to be a red herring. But this was just one of several of these things that happened while I was at Stromlo. There must have been a couple of others, because I can remember at one stage Campbell Wade must have been up there with a few people. There were a series of talks down at ANU. I'm not sure whether it was the opening of something or whether it was some special... Maybe there was some special time when Herman Bondi was out. He was out for one summer. And maybe there were some people up from Sydney and they had a sort of general symposium then.
But would you say that this cooperation was primarily fostered through Pozzi and Bach?
I would say entirely, because I'm not too sure whether it died out. It probably died out to a certain extent when Joe Pozzi left the scene. Certainly when Bart Bock left, just about all forms of cooperation died.
And that was mid-60s, 66?
Yeah, about something? 66.
Right. So... You then did the survey that the Rogers, Campbell, and White Oak H alpha survey of the galactic plane, and it would seem to me that the logical thing then would be that you would become an optical astronomer. How is it that you got involved in other things?
Well, this was sort of I think just a case of taking things as they came along. Certainly when we were doing this H alpha mission region survey. One of the first things that was done after the completion of it was that Joe Pozzi wrote up one time and said he'd like to have somebody come down and talk about the interpretation with respect to a low-frequency survey that Alex Shane had done, and which Max Komisarov had taken over when Alex died. Now, of the people on the original survey, I'm not sure that Alex Rogers was still, he may have been overseas at this stage, but Colin Campbell, who is one of the names on the survey, had left. So it was up to me to spend spent a week down in Sydney with Max, and we poured over these things and drew a fantastic number of overlays and whatnot. So it was sort of through this type of work that I'd be became interested in radio astronomy. And I think the other thing was that when I finished at Stromlo in 1962, I had to find something to do while I was waiting to go to America. So, and Joe Pozzi had a position available for someone who was willing to help on the pointing problem.
So on the New Parkes dish.
On the New Parkes dish, which had just started at the end of 61. It was very new. It was a very exciting period, because the dish had just started up. We were using LTAS coordinates in the beginning. We had fantastic tables of LTAS coordinates as a function of sidereal time.
You didn't have the fancy optical conversion thing working then, you mean?
No. It was just setting the telescope LTAS, and at a certain time the source would drift through, so you'd have a whole lot of these drift curves, and the idea would be to work out the first order results on the telescope pointing.
How long was it before that conversion system got?
Probably about 3 months.
I see.
But I remember it was quite a headache in those first 2 or 3 months, because to choose sources for pointing, we were using 3C sources. And 3C sources were point sources at 3C wavelengths. But of course, once you start to look at 20 centimetres, then things like, 3C227 and some of the other ones, or particularly 327, became multi-component jobs.
Right.
And so the pointing problem those first 2 or 3 months were was almost a step in the wrong direction, until we worked out which sources were point sources and which were extended.
You didn't have any suitable catalogue of 20 centimetre sort of frequency sources and with sizes?
Not size information, no. There was
there was probably Caltech some... Or, didn't they do an 800 megahertz survey early on?
There may have been... But I think at that stage there were... I think we knew that some sources were fairly small and angular size, but there are other ones that we didn't know were small.
And you needed a whole grid, of course.
Were large, and you know, some of these had wings and whatnot, and a lot of these things hadn't been worked out previously. So it was with a little bit of amazement that some of our calibration sources became double and triple too.
Well, we've got some science done as well as engineering.
Yeah, so that, you know, that was sort of my start into radio astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
And on the sideline, I entered into the polarization program with Frank Gardner, where we started off with attempting to find polarization. But when I left radiophysics, I spent my Carnegie Institute fellowship was for optical work.
And which years was that in?
This was 62 to 64. But it just so happened at the end of 64, Radhakrishnan left Caltech, and Gordon Stanley wanted someone to fill in there for a year, and I just happened to be around. So, you know, it was a matter of timing.
I see, so you stayed on.
And so at that stage, I went into radio astronomy, into there was an H-line maser on at Caltech at that stage. And
okay, before we get into that, let's just jump back. Now, you do have a couple short papers in 62 and 63 with mm-hmm. Gardner.
Mm-hmm.
About 20 centimeter polarization. Right, so you did get a little bit done after the pointing, apparently.
Oh, yes.
Can you tell me about, first of all, what was your motivation to work on the polarization? Was it the NRL results? Or?
Well, I believe, and I don't know whether this is true, that one of the things that John Bolton was keen on looking for when he was back at Caltech was polarization. And I don't know for sure, but I think Jim Roberts said at one stage that they'd spend quite a bit of time looking for polarization without any success. And I think John felt that when he came to Australia with a bigger dish and higher frequencies, that there'd be a greater chance of finding mm-hmm. polarization. Now, so when I started at radiophysics, there was a general feeling. And this was also motivated by Pawsey, who had the motivation from trying to look for galactic polarization rather than extragalactic polarization. There was a feeling that a polarization program should begin. So for the first attempts, we had a pair of double dipoles on. We're working at 74 and 20 centimeters.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, well, as history shows, unfortunately, we first chose the brightest sources because our receivers were not very good and we wanted as high a signal to noise as possible. And so unfortunately we chose the brightest sources, which just happened to be the highest luminosity sources, and history has shown that these are the ones that have the last polarization. So we had this against us on one count. The other count was because we used a double dipole system, there was some mutual interference, and so that when one rotated the dipoles, there was a definite gain variation, mm-hmm. which off the source was very, very complicated, and so one had to be very careful to subtract the on-source rotation from the off-source at exactly the same position in the sky. Take out any
same as an L.
Yeah, yeah, same as elevation. And of course some of these tricks we weren't aware of until some time.
So the results in these papers, did they suffer from some of these early errors?
They didn't, no. The first detection suffered a little bit from this because apart from Centaurus, the first detection that I can recall, or the first positive result was on 3C270, which is a 12% polarized radio source at centimeter wavelengths. and there the both the on-source and off-source rotations looked horrible. But when we finally had averaged several sets of data and subtracted the on from the off from the on,
mm-hmm.
then quite a reasonable sine wave persisted. And once we had sufficient data, because we had an LDAS telescope, then we had observations at different parallactic angles, which showed that the sine wave was a constant position angle rather than constant feed angle. And the latter, of course, would have been an instrumental effect.
Right. So you were reasonably confident about these.
Yeah. Once we noticed that the sine wave wasn't constant with feed angle.
Right.
Because with these high brightness objects, with a double dipole system, one did get a sine wave on sorts, but this was a purely instrumental gain effect, but it had the distinction of being constant with feed angle, allied to the telescope rather than to the sky.
So in fact, in that case, is it not true that the alta azimuth mount helps you? As opposed to an equatorial mount.
Oh, yes. This
is often argued that an equatorial mount is better for polarization work. But in this case, it might have been more confusing as to... is that true?
Yeah, well, it's true and it's not true, in that an equatorial mount can give you results at a constant, constant position on the sky. Whereas with an LDAS telescope, because the parallactic angle is changing,
right.
then your feed angle system, your feed angle scale, is changing with respect to the position angle scale.
Right.
Now, with small angular diameter sources, this helps you because this gives you the chance of differentiating between a true polarization as a polarization with respect to the sky. One can differentiate between that and a polarization associated with the feed angle scale
right,
of the telescope.
Right.
On the other hand, for large areas of sky, and if one is scanning a certain polarization, then the problem is that the feed angle has to be varied
to compensate
for the change.
And then you don't know how to calibrate it out.
That's
your final
right.
Map.
The calibration is difficult. So there are fors and against.
Right. Now, can you? Tell me, what was the astrophysical interest in this polarization at that time? What were the questions that you were...
I think there are two questions. One, I suppose the basic question was to use this information together with the synchrotron information for the radiation and just to try and get more, to get a better insight of the radiation mechanism in radio sources. So that is, we're after information which was associated with the source itself. The other interesting thing was that after we had sufficient data at two or three wavelengths, we were able to derive the Faraday rotation. And as soon as we had sort of minimal statistics on this, it became fairly obvious that the Faraday rotation was associated with the latitude, galactic latitude of the sources. And so here there was an immediate inference that the interstellar medium was causing this mm-hmm. Faraday rotation.
Now, did you expect this at all?
Little was known about polarization in those days, and so one didn't go into this project saying that, if we have this Faraday rotation and we plot it up, this is going to happen. But I think immediately that we found that sources near the plane had large Faraday rotation, and that ones further away from the plane had small Faraday rotation. I think immediately we
right.
cottoned on to this. I think it's fair enough to say that our best results for this came from that first paper in 1962, because there we only had a few sources, and they all seemed to obey this picture.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, of course, now with the 300 or 400 sources for which we have data, the picture of Fano rotation versus galactic latitude by no means clear.
It's not so clean now.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, that's a constantly recurring story in science.
But in those days, the answer seemed quite trivial.
Right. Well, now, in your judgment, did in fact this polarization information really help us understand radio sources?
I think it did. I think there's still a lot to be cleaned up about this in interpretation, particularly with circular polarization that's more or less come as a result of linear polarization. I think where linear polarization has helped is that it's given us some information on field orientation. Now, what I'm thinking of specifically is for the low luminosity, the extended objects, in which there is quite high polarization. I think it's given us some feeling for the fact that there's been some sort of outflow of material, and perhaps some confinement under the outer edges by, I don't know what they call, ram pressure or something.
You mean the fact that it's an ordered field? I mean,
right. The field is in many of these low luminosity, large angular size things is quite ordered, particularly at the outer extremities. And it's usually the degree of polarization is usually quite high at the outer extremities, as though there is being some confined by interstellar medium. Intergalactic medium, that's correct. So I think it's given us some feeling as to how sources might evolve. For the high brightness objects, I think there's still a few problems there, because for some of these, the as one goes to higher frequencies, then they're becoming to show polarization. So it's obvious that these high brightnesses, maybe there's some turbulent motion or something within a small angular size, and the differential Faraday rotation just causes the lack of polarization at lower frequencies.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there's another problem with things like quasars, which have these multi-component energy sources, in that there seem to be these objects seem to contain both polarized and unpolarized components, or components which are polarized at different by different amounts or different degrees and at different angles, and so one gets some sort of a beating effect. But I don't think these problems have been fully looked into. One needs a lot of information on.
Now, you were a Carnegie Fellow for 2 years, and can you just tell me what topic you worked in without going into details?
These were more or less optical extension of the work I'd done at Stromlo on O and B stars. One of the projects I did there was just working on the interstellar reddening law.
Using
purely optical.
Which telescopes?
Well, this was using the 100-inch and the 60-inch.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there's one thing I forgot, that while I was over there, John Bolton put the squeeze on me to do some work for him. He'd always been worried by the fact that the Palomar-Schmidt survey only went south as far as minus 36 at its most southern extremities.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he heard I was going over there, he said, "Well, can you take this down as far as possible?" So I said, "Well, I'll do my best." And so I went over there and talked over the problem with Ira Bowen, who was head of the observatory stage. And Ira said, "Oh," he said, "no," he said, "you'd be wasting your time. There's just too much rotation of the image, plus the extension of the image due to chromatic aberration, that it's just not worth it." So at Caltech that time, there was a fellow called Tom Matthews. I think he's in Maryland now.
Yes, I know him.
And so Tom was interested in getting this done also, so he went off to Palomar. He had a run down there and came back with one plate, and we took it up to Ira Bowen and we poured out for a day or so, and finally convinced him it could be done. And so this really began the southern extension, which had been hanging around for a few years.
Right.
And
that was one additional declination? Or
no, this
two
was two declinations.
Minus 36 and minus 42?
Yeah, minus 36 and minus 42. So the southernmost extremity was down to minus 45.
Right. And you only did it in the red, I believe.
Yeah, it was sort of mongrelized red. The problem was to get as much light through to make up for the fairly high extinction at these right. southern declinations. So one wanted a maximum bandwidth. One wanted the red wavelength region to cut out the enlargement of the image due to chromatic aberration, which and really blows up in the blue.
Right, and also the extinction would be worse, of course.
That's right, yes, the extinction is better in the red. Then there was another thing that was important, was that one of the biggest night sky lines is 5577. And so it was always a good thing to have a wavelength which cut out just in front of that. So this, it was sort of an orange, I guess one would describe it as an orange passband, with which we used orange plexiglass filter plus 103 AE, which was a normal mm-hmm. red emulsion. Mm-hmm. And so the characteristic was such, which I think it cut off around about 5700, 5800. And so it was pretty well up from this night skyline.
I see.
In addition, there were fairly stringent requirements about taking the observations, in that one had to, it had to be done symmetrically about meridian,
right,
to within 1 or 2 minutes, else one would get a rotation of the field, an elongation of the images at the corners. So it was a problem, and another great problem was the fact that when one's looking along the meridians down south, one virtually looks over San Diego Airport.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the plates had the plane spiraling in to land. But nevertheless, this was done. You know, it took about 2 years. And in fact, I think I was I was in my third year in America, but at Caltech when we'd finished this. And it was only to be done as a private survey for John to use. But then Martin Schmidt said, well, we have this, and there might be one or two other people wanting to use it. Why don't you write a letter around to see if people would be interested? And I think the first time I did the rounds, I think there were probably 100
sure.
requests for it. And
now it's more or less a standard part of the survey.
That's right, yes. Well, it's now being superseded by the SRC
right,
and ESAS.
But now, after only 15 years, though.
So. Yeah, well, We at the time we thought, oh well, it might be okay for about 3 or 4 years until it's superseded.
Yeah. That's interesting. But now tell me about what you did when Bolton, when you began working for Bolton at Owens Valley.
Oh well, John Bolton was back here at that stage.
Well, he was back here.
Yeah, John came back here in end of 1961. But he'd left Gordon Stanley behind.
It was Gordon Stanley. I'm sorry, you said it.
Right. And Gordon Stanley was sort of he had a rather unfortunate position. He was sort of unofficial head of the thing, but he didn't have tenure. And so this produced a lot of complicated political problems at Caltech. But while I was at the observatories, I had quite a bit to do with Caltech. I think one reason was because Jim Roberts had just come back from Caltech, and so people knew a lot about the Australians there. And then Olin Wilson was at Santa Barbara Street at the time, and mm-hmm. but his wife was Gordon's secretary.
I see.
So because of this, there was a fair liaison between the two places, and also my wife had a job working for Olin Egan for a couple of years down there. So I got to know people down at Caltech. I knew Radhakrishnan quite early in the piece. Mm-hmm. In fact, I even when Radhakrishnan was there, when he just built his maser, I went up there for a couple of weeks and worked with him. And another time, I worked with Ken Kellerman over, and
was
someone to help out during one summer period. So this was all the time. This was the time that I was at.
Well,
I was still doing optical.
Right, mainly doing optical. Yeah.
So I think it was only obvious for Gordon to invite me to stay on down there after I'd finished, to fill in the hole in the H-line project that Rad left when he left there.
And so what did you do?
Well, the time that I was at Santa Barbara Street, I was mainly interested in H-line work. In fact, there was one paper published somewhere with Radhakrishnan and George Sealstead and me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when Rad had built his maser. Now, when I went down there for the final year, there's a fellow called Rogstad,
right,
who had just arrived. He was a student there, And it's rather funny because when I was working there, he had been working with another Australian called Wyndham. You've heard of John Wyndham?
From the 3C identification paper.
That's right, yes. I think he came from Cambridge. English. But anyway, he was a Christian Scientist. And he was sort of a difficult character to work with. And Dave had started off his postgraduate work with him.
Mm-hmm.
But they had more or less fallen out, these two. over Christian ideologies, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so Gordon... was looking around for another project, and I just arrived at this stage, ostensibly coming down to do H-line work. So Gordon came along and asked whether Dave could do H-line work, and so that's where his H-line infantry started off.
I see. Now, what year are we talking about now when you...
This is 65.
65, okay.
In fact, no, I probably started September 64, I think.
And what did you learn from that year of... H1 work?
Oh, I think it was very interesting. I learned the solder. We had to build all our filters and things there, and I think probably I learned a lot about how to work an interferometer for the first mm-hmm. time. The previous occasions, I'd just gone up there when the whole equipment was set up. But this time, we were using tunnel diode receivers, because Gordon felt too miserly in forking out money for the liquid helium to feed the masers. I think we got our own back because the computing bill was fantastic. But these receivers had just arrived, were put on, and when I arrived there was no multi-channel receivers, so we had to sit down and build a multi-channel receiver.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think probably 6 months. First 6 months there, we were spending soldering and testing. Yes.
Right. I'm trying to think. Was there any other hydrogen line interferometry going on at that time? Was this the only place? I can't think of any other.
I don't think so. I think so.
Jodrell Bank. I don't think so.
No, I think there. In fact, there was little H line work, extragalactic H line work at all going on at that stage.
Mort Roberts was. Plugging away.
That's right. There was there had been a Harvard. I think Epstein had just finished a thesis.
Right.
At Harvard.
Right.
I
don't think there was interferometric work anywhere.
No.
So you people must have been by yourself at that stage.
Yeah, we were by ourselves, and I think we found a couple of a pretty obvious traps. In that when we first started up. We felt that we could immediately get the rotation curves just by plotting up the phase.
Right, as a function of position.
As a function of position. Now, of course, experience now shows us that as one gets further out, that this doesn't show us what the rotation curve is doing at all. But in those early days, we start off a survey for trying to detect H1, and secondly for trying to get some information on the rotation curves.
Right.
I think in retrospect, a lot of the masses and whatnot that we computed from these rotation curves are wrong, but because we assumed too much.
Nevertheless, right? Though, the results from that paper were used for many years, and there was nothing that better than it for quite a while.
Oh yeah, I think that. There is a rather unfortunate thing that happened about this. I think later experience showed us that our inferences regarding the derivation of the rotation curve was incorrect, and that in fact one should have the full synthesis. but people tend to forget that in those days it was very difficult to change the spacing of the telescope, firstly. In fact, one didn't do this at Caltech, one just had long runs.
Right.
Whereas when I went back a few years later, one could change these in 3 or 4 hours and it was no problem. The second thing was that there was no elaborate synthesis computing reduction program like that was developed at Vestibor.
Mm-hmm.
So that one was more or less one will have had to rely on just a single position angle synthesis.
You had to do your own software.
Fitting models.
Right.
A lot of them which were
models.
So, but unfortunately, you know, I don't know whether you heard about this, but Rogstad, a few years later, was had to leave. His position was taken from him at Caltech. Mm-hmm. And when I was talking to Gordon Stanley just after this happened, I was rather shocked when this happened. But unfortunately, it happened before I heard about it. Mm-hmm. And so in no way at all could I be any way helpful keeping him there. But the story was, according to Gordon, that Dave had for his thesis, and this early H-line work formed his thesis, mm-hmm. That he'd really been doing incorrect research, you know, that he should have done such and such and such. I mean, it's all very well in hindsight to say this.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I feel like you, that in those days it was the first step in developing this whole reduction procedure. So I think it's rather unfortunate this story about Dave sort of acted against him, because he was one of the beginners.
Okay, well, as I told you, I think mid-60s is where I'll cut it off, so unless you can think of any aspects we've missed before that point.
I don't think so. I think the story of Ron Braceful and pushing the button, I think you probably get that from Brian Cooper.
Or Frank Gardner, I may already have it from him.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But I think it's true that Ron's paper was withheld by fair means or foul.
until the Cooper and Price paper could come out.
Right. Yes, I think it was Cooper and Price, or it might have been a third person involved.
Okay, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. The interview with John White Oak on 27 February 1978.